Hear me, islands of nations. Prick up your ears, you people from far away. Before I was conceived, Jehovah appointed me. Before even my mother felt any sympathy for me, he signified my uniqueness. That was from Isaiah chapter 49, verse 1 of the Ward Green Version of 2003, the Bible. Jehovah's Word. And he's the true God, Jehovah, the one who created all things. He has a name, and the way we know that his name is Jehovah is we can determine that in an empirical way when we pray in the name of Jehovah through the name of his Son, Jesus Christ. He hears our prayer. That's how we can prove that that's his true name, Jehovah, because our prayers will either be answered or they will not be answered. And when we pray in the name of Jehovah, we can determine, is that his name or is it not? Now, left, the picture on the left, here in the Ark of Urartu, chapter 4, paragraph 6, is the winged bull of Sargon. When I mentioned that in an earlier study, I didn't really know that this picture was in this article, but I remembered the winged bulls, and I thought, well, didn't Darius, the much later King Darius, who ruled about 522 BCE, didn't he also use the winged bull? And he did. He was a Persian king. But the Assyrian kings also, at the time of Sargon and Sennacherib, used the winged bull as a symbol of their power. Now, Abraham's time, beginning to read now, paragraph 6 of chapter 4, the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express, was one of famine. And I did my research. I looked it up again. And I've had to dig back for some articles, but for these articles about famine, where did I put the articles? They're over here. Okay, yeah. I've got them here. It was great. I looked it up, and it's still there on Wikipedia. The article about famine and the article about the old kingdom of Egypt, which mentions famine. So I'm going to bring those in right now. The old kingdom of Egypt. When you search for the word famine, you find immediately in the 22nd century BC drought in the region that resulted in a drastic drop in precipitation. Abraham was born 2206 in our chronology, just before the 22nd century. So that would be totally consistent with the idea, because there was a drought and Abraham went down to Egypt in the Bible because of the drought. So, I mean, there's more to read there, but just to keep things short, we go to the article famine also. And even in the Wikipedia article famine, and I've saved these articles for later reference now because they keep changing these articles every time I make a statement regarding any proof of any chronology, they change their articles. At least many of their articles do get changed. I'm not saying all of them do, but a famine. Okay, so to find the Egyptian famine, in the article famine, you look up the word Egypt, and it says in the mid-22nd century BC, a sudden and short-lived climatic change that caused reduced rainfall. Guess what? Abraham was, in 2131 BCE, 75 years old, which is when he moved to Canaan. And so this drought, okay, so the drought that was talked about as being in Canaan, I did research also to ascertain that very often the drought was in more than one region, not just in Canaan, but in, you know, or not just Egypt, but Canaan as well. And we saw that in the story of Joseph in the Bible too, where the famine that transpired or occurred in Egypt also affected Canaan. So this makes for a good correspondence here of the famine of the time of Abraham with the recorded information about Egypt, and it confirms our chronology for the date of Abraham by doing that. Okay, very important chronological confirmation. Because if we didn't find the famine, I mean, we'd say, well, you know, we'd be doing a lot of hand-waving to try and explain it. But we don't have to. So in those articles, Old Kingdom and Famine, we find proof of this famine in the 22nd century, which is exactly the time of Abraham. You know, within, I mean, they can't date the famine that accurately, surely. But we can date Abraham, perhaps, very precisely in our chronology. I mean, we don't see much reason to doubt it as far as our chronology goes, so we're not adjusting our chronology because these other facts are more dubious, which are the facts of some ancient famine as far as trying to give a date for it. The book by Mr. Fotheringham gives Manetho's Egyptian rule, according to Africanus, as 808 years from Menes or Narmer to Suphis. Narmer to Suphis, or Menes to Suphis, the second king of the fourth dynasty. We're going to do a little math. So here is Suphis. He's got 63 years in dynasty 4. So we add up all the years that came in the dynasties prior to that, going back to Menes. So 263 years for dynasty 1, plus 302 years for dynasty 2, plus 214 years for dynasty 3 in Africanus, the list of Africanus, the left-hand column, and 29 years for Soros. Total, 808 years. Okay. But by the way, this is extremely important, the 29 years of Soros, because I had been referring to an earlier Wikipedia article that has since then been changed, which showed that the reign of the king who preceded Joseph, who was Amenemhat II in our chronology, he ruled 29 years in the older Wikipedia article, so I've preserved those as well now. So I've got evidence for that, right there. This king, Amenemhat II, in the older version of the article, before they changed it, he was dated as ruling 1929 to 1895. Okay. But his predecessor, we look at him, I think he's still dated, yeah, as having ruled until 1926, according to one dating here. So, yeah, so I need to save his as well. I don't know if I've saved his. I think I did. Let me check. I need to know whether I've saved these things before they disappear. Senusret the first. Where is he? Second. Second. Oh, I didn't save it. But anyway, I'll probably want to look at an older version of it as well. Senusret the first. Let's just save it right now. Okay. Just for now. But if his rule ended in 1926, then he was co-ruling with Amenemhat the second. Whose reign we were looking at here. So therefore, his reign began in 1926, and also if you look at his successor, Senusret II, who we are identifying as Joseph, you're going to see something very remarkable there. That's Senusret III. Where is it? No, this is Senusret II, right? And they identify his year one, even in the most recent version of Wikipedia, as 1897, because he co-ruled with his predecessor again. So the only sole rule would be from 1926 to 1897, and that is exactly 29 years for that king. Listed in Fotheringham as having 29 years who preceded Suffus. So therefore, Sorus is possibly Amenemhat II, and he was succeeded by Suffus, who is evidently Joseph. And look at the similarity in the name, Suffus and Joseph. Similarity of name as well. Fascinating. But now, if this is Joseph and he ruled 808 years after Menes, then we do the calculation. We had Menes as 2774 for the eclipse date, minus 43 years for the building of the tower, minus 808 years gives 1923. And that just coincides precisely. Whether that could possibly be by chance seems irrational, but that coincides exactly with our date for Joseph as being the time when he began to rule Egypt as second in command with the Pharaoh. That's his 30th birthday that year in our chronology from the Bible. So let's just read. It says, which in the genealogy is when Joseph became second ruler of Egypt, identified earlier by us in a previous article, in other words, as Sesostris II, who is succeeded by Sesostris III, who would be the second Suffus after the first Suffus in that list of Fotheringham. So the names would correspond perfectly because they're the same name for those two in a row. Usually two pharaohs do not have the same name, one after the other. They usually, the grandfather would have the same name as the grandson, but not the father and son. So that's further confirmation. Who is in turn succeeded by Amenemhat III, who's called Menkerez. We also identify him still as Minos. Minos was the famous king of Crete, but also the similarity in the name is noted there, Menkerez and Minos. And he was the one who built Lake Moeris. It had to do with the building of Joseph's Canal, which we know happened according to the wonderful legend about Joseph that says he was 100 years old when he took 3 years to build Joseph's Canal. And that fits perfectly in the chronology because Joseph was born in 1954, late in the year, BCE 1954, 100 years later is 1853, and 1850 was when he completed it 3 years later. In our chronology, that's a very significant date in our chronology, 1850. One reason being that 3 times 1850 is 5550, which is the creation of Adam. But that's just another coincidence, right? They're all just coincidences. The agreement is striking. It's striking the letter or character for China. The center. It's striking the center. For one thing, because it makes Joseph perhaps ruling as Giza's pyramid is built. Read on. We'll read on here. We follow only our best leads in research such as this. We don't follow things that don't work. We have to have stuff that works. That's what that says, right? The similarity of the names together with the exactness of the chronology makes this an excellent lead. Very amazing. Suffus is also known as Cheops or Khufu, and he was known for having built the Great Pyramid of Giza, as well as for having a son, Djedefra. Compare that, his son Djedefra, with the name of Ephraim, the last letters of Djedefra being the same as the first letters of Ephraim, Joseph's son, Ephraim, or Ephraim. That's another coincidence. And then we, okay, so this is just remarkable, but this is common knowledge about Sufis having been also known as Cheops or Khufu. That's not something we're discovering, okay? And his son's name is not something we're discovering. It's well known also. The 27 Egyptian kings from Menes to Sufis, each ruling 30 years, if we gave them 30 years each, let's say, gives 810 years total. 27 times 30 is 81. Times 10, which is 810 years. Compare that with the 808 that we got from the Africanus list of Manetho. Pretty close, 810 and 808. Again, pretty amazing correspondence. The Arabian list of Egyptian kings from Mr. Crosthwaite's book Synchronology, pages 233 to 234, gives 12 kings from Ham's son Bisar to Tulis of Abraham's day, and it offers that Mizraim, or Miser, is the grandson of Ham, further having Joseph at the reign of the 16th king Ryan, son of Walad. Here's the list from the book, page 233. Biser, right there, or his, he built Miser, that is Cairo. Miser, the son of Biser, with the second king on the list. And then all the way down to the 12th king Tulis. In his reign, Abraham came into Egypt. We read there in Mr. Crosthwaite's book from 1839, Synchronology, on page 233. And we go down to page 234 and we see that Ryan was the son of Walad, and they were both kings of Egypt. And Ryan was said to have flourished 400 years before the time of Moses, and also it was during his reign that Joseph was sold into Egypt. So that's Ryan, the Pharaoh, in the time of Joseph. So from Nimrod, who would be the third king on this list, of the Arabian list, because we take Nimrod as the son of Mizraim, right? Even though he's called something else here, in the Arabian list he's called Kift or Kibd. Kibd. The Copts are named after him, it says. And we're calling him Nimrod, the third king. Okay. So from the third king to Joseph, who's number 16, the king of Joseph's time was number 16, Walad, or Ryan, rather, the son of Walad, number 16. That'd be 13 reigns, right? Non-inclusive, excluding the reign of the last king. So that's, you know, we include the reign of the first king, and then we just go to the end of the reign of Walad, who was the father of Ryan. And that's 13 reigns exclusive, in other words. A difference of 16 minus 3. 13 reigns of 62 years each, very nearly. 13 times 62, what's that? I don't remember having calculated this. I hope it works. I hope it's correct. Yeah, let's see. Yeah, 806, you see, that's the right number of years again. It allows that the generation might be above 70 years, provided that the kingship is not only inherited. So there could have been some kings that were not the son of the previous. So the generation could have been, you know, from father to the firstborn son, could have been more than 70 years at the more ancient times, in the ancient times, the most ancient times. Prior, you know, just following the deluge, there was 500 years. Then there was this period of Egypt we're talking about now. After those 500 years that came after the deluge, by that time people didn't live as long, but they were still living a lot longer than people live today. So the generation could have been above 70 years, is what we're saying here. But the 62 years is just a number that we might be missing some of the names of the kings too. So there are different ways of finding out or explaining this in truth. But Mr. Crosthwaite accuses the Egyptian historians on page 230 of his book of expanding the roles of their listed kings. Well, maybe we should try and find that reference, because I like using books when it's just they're not always available, right? In Sincellus, the chief difference consists in the far greater number of names of kings contained in his list, which has four, five, and even six times as many names as some of his predecessors. This I attribute plainly to repetition and interpolation, he says, by the Egyptian priests and historians during the interval. Okay, he says, so I've already read the part, the quote from him, that's even better than the sentence I wrote here. But the Arabs list 29 Egyptian kings before Solomon of Israel. So that would be, well, these are the calculations. Nimrod to Abram is from the 12th generation to the 3rd, or the 12th king to the 3rd, is 9, right? And we take the difference of the time of Abram, 2147, compared to the time of Nimrod, which is 2774 minus 43. What's that? 2731 or something like that. Okay, minus 2147. I hate having to calculate these things over and over again, because they've been done in the past, but if we don't do it, nobody's going to believe it. Minus 2147. And even if we do it, people won't believe it. Like, that's the whole... 584. 584 divided by 9 is 64 years, roughly. Okay, good. So we see it works. Also, the next calculation from Nimrod to Joseph gives 62 years, which is 16 minus 3 kings, 13 in a row, in other words. We just mentioned 13, right? Just did that calculation. And then 2774 minus 43 minus 1018, which is the year of Solomon, with 1923 being that Joseph beginning to rule. 1018 for the rule of Solomon. At this time of this article, I had his rule as beginning in 1018 instead of 1017, so it's close. The average for those 29 minus 3, or 26 kings of Egypt, would be 65 years per reign. Again, it's always about 60-some years for these kings of Egypt, their average reign, which seems very high, honestly, right, by today's standard. Now, but let's just be aware that, you know, these are very ancient numbers, and there may be various reasons why they're different, but let's see if we can finish this paragraph. Hence, the Arabian list of Egyptian kings, that's the Arabian list that we got these from, these numbers, 62 years per reign, is, it confirms that the general patriarchal chronology of the Bible is correct. Okay, no, we're just not even talking about the number of years, just that the general patriarchal chronology of the Bible is correct, because Abraham, who is the 10th from Shem, relates to Tulis, who is the 12th from Ham, in generations, or in the list of names, which is possibly generations, right? In the case of kings, it could be more than one king per generation, because a brother could rule or something like that. The 12th rule, in any case, may not correspond to 12th son, which is explaining what I just said. It is furthermore typical of kings to strive early in life to generate a son in further assistance of a descendancy, in order to assure themselves, right, a dynasty or a descendancy and a continuation of their bloodline. The 27 kings of Manetho, according to Africanus, as related to us by Sincellus, as presented by Mr. D.R. Fotheringham in the Chronology of the Old Testament, which we already looked at. There are 27 according to... I didn't count them just now, but are there 27? Well, there were... is 1, and there were 9, 8, and 9 is 17, and 9. 26 and 1, 27. So it looks like I did that mass correct. The 27 kings of Miniso from Cincellus, but according to Africanus, and from his version of Miniso, it's passed through all those different people. And Fotheringham, his book, is where we got it from. So it passed through all those different people's hands to get to us, as compared to the 16 kings of the Arabian. There are 27 compared to 16 of the Arabian list. That shows how little trust may be justified in any non-biblical sources. So, yeah, if there were 27 instead of 16, if there were twice as many kings, then the average rule would be 30 years instead of 60 years, right? So that could solve our problem. Maybe the Arabian tradition just isn't complete. It doesn't have all the kings, which only the most memorable ones, perhaps, which would explain it. Whatever the case with the king's reigns, whether there be kings missing or extra names thrown in, the date of the eclipse of Nimrod couples the deluge to rule in Egypt. The kings of Egypt are connected to the time of the deluge by means of the eclipse of Nimrod, which was also the beginning of the Egyptian calendar, right, as we saw, coincided with the beginning of this important cycle of the star Sothis, or Sirius, the brightest star in the night sky, which has a cycle of 1460 years. And the Egyptians followed it religiously, this star. So the beginning of their calendar is very logically placed at the start of one of these Sothic cycles, which is in 2774 BCE, right? And that's the eclipse of Nimrod that occurred at that time of that beginning of that particular Sothic cycle, 2774. That's what connects the deluge, which would otherwise have no connection. Like, we wouldn't have a definite point in time between the deluge and the rulers of Egypt. That's the end of our study for today. Chapter 4, paragraph 6 of the Ark of Urartu. Thank you for listening and watching. Thank you so much. And we do have, maybe, I don't have any other thing to say about anything really today, but we've got a few more minutes, so I'm sure there will be things to say. There always are things that can be said, whether I forgot to say them before or, but I don't like to divulge. It's like there are lots of things you say, well, I can tell you, but I'd have to kill you, right? You can't just give away your personal, you know, the details of what you're doing to just strangers, right? You just don't do that. You can't do that because these pieces of information, these facts, these details don't belong to anybody else. They have no business knowing about these things, so you can't give out that information. But I could talk about lead acid battery technology again. I think I want to do that because it's such a difficult and, well, first of all, lead, it's a difficult and disappointing technology, but at the same time, it's a very old technology from in the 1800s, in about 1860, lead acid battery technology was invented, and it's been such a great technology that they still have it today. I mean, we're still using it. Now we have AGM, which is a more effective form, safer form, better form in some ways than the flooded lead acid batteries, which are dangerous because you can spill acid. Sulfuric acid is used in those batteries, and so we're still using lead acid. Now we're using it as, in some cases, the AGM batteries, which are absorbent glass mat, which are still lead acid, but they're absorbent glass mat, which means the acid is not liquid in the battery. It's absorbed. It's in the form of this already absorbed liquid in the glass mat. And it makes them a lot safer because they can't spill any acid when you break them open. So if they get fractured in a collision or, you know, whatever, there's no acid going to spill out. Or they're more vibration resistant too, these batteries, these new AGMs. But there are problems with them. They can be more sensitive to overcharging. And yeah, you've got to be careful. You can damage them in some ways by overcharging, which you can't damage in the same way. I mean, speaking about the flooded lead acid batteries, you can't damage them as easily in that way by overcharging as you can with the AGMs. But some AGMs I know will not, they won't charge in your car properly using the alternator that your car has. You can't use your car's alternator to charge if it's an older car that wasn't intended to be used to charge AGMs. A lot of the older cars will not charge some of the newer AGMs, let's say. I mean, you can get AGMs now that will charge just about by any car. You know, you can put it in an older car if you get the right AGM battery, so you've got to be aware of that. But, I mean, yeah, so let's talk about lead acid. Lead acid, when they get discharged, when the voltage is low, they start to form a sulfate. Sulfation is harmful. And when they start to form a sulfate, if it's not reversed by charging, which is what happens when you charge it, that reverses the sulfation. If you don't reverse it soon enough, then that sulfation can become permanent. So that's why it's good to keep your battery always charged. So every time you go home, you should recharge your battery again or keep it on a maintainer and make sure you check the voltage of your battery regularly. Something that I wasn't doing, evidently, when my last battery failed, I wasn't checking it. Like, not independent of the charger. I was keeping it on the charger, keeping it maintained, but I wasn't verifying that the battery itself had any juice in it. I wasn't measuring the voltage of it, and I wasn't testing it using my battery tester to see how many cold cranking amps it could produce, which is a little device. The battery tester just hooks up to your positive and negative, and it just takes a few seconds to calculate how many cold cranking amps your battery can produce and tells you the internal resistance. And you monitor those things over time and see how they're changing. That's it for today's study, though. It's October 15th, 2024 of the Common Era. I love you very much. I'm Ward Green. And the time is 20:35 hours, North American Eastern Daylight Time. Thank you for listening and watching once again. As I said, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to get that information out today because that was so monumental. This is Lib Dusty. This is Cassie saying bye for now. And that was perhaps our most interesting study in this article up till now, I think.